until 11. You're listening to Mitchell's Front Page on 94.7 The Pulse. Proudly brought to you by Cario Waste Management. Station sponsor.
Coming up this hour, Monday Sport, we're also going to be joined by Nick Economou from Monash University and Bodie Dittloff from the Circular Head Chronicle. Is the Geelong Christmas tree really the biggest Christmas tree out there? Well, we'll find out a little bit later on. These are election results, the counting that's taking place. I can see in South Barwon that they haven't actually counted any of the early votes as yet, even though they have updated the details on the website for 9 a.m, but they haven't actually updated the totals for the early votes as yet. But a man that knows a lot more about this than I do is Nick Economou from Monash University. How are you, Nick?
Good, thanks, Mitchell.
Now, I just wanted to talk with you about the election result on Saturday night. I mean, what surprised you the most about what happened on Saturday night, or was it all as expected?
Look, I think that it was as expected. I mean, the polls have been indicating that there was going to be a swing against the government. The only issue was going to be whether we would get one of those elections that you sometimes get in Australian politics where there are big swings against the government, but the government can defend its marginals, or whether this is going to happen uniformly. As it turned out, the swings were sufficient in those ultra-marginal government seats, well, former government seats, to allow them to come over. So it's really interesting, if you look at them as a block, they're almost exactly the same seats that swapped from Labor to Coalition in 2010. So there's this block of about eight seats that went Coalition or went Liberal last time and have gone back to Labor this time. Even the Green victory in Melbourne was anticipated, I think, because of the east-west tunnel issue, controversy. The things that were unexpected, the things that I was quite surprised by on the night, the first one was the way in which the Green vote held up, because the prevailing orthodoxy was that the Greens had peaked and they might fall away. And the Green vote held up, and held up quite well in all sorts of strange places, including the countryside. And secondly, of course, we had the independent success, even though that's to be confirmed, but it looks like an independent is going to win the seat of Shepparton off the Nationals. And the third really interesting thing is the result in the Legislative Council, where we've had a replication, a rerun of what happened in the Senate in the last federal election, with these micro-parties, especially from the right, seemingly doing quite well. Now, that did surprise me. I didn't expect that at all. I thought that having seen that phenomenon at work in the last federal election and all of the angst and criticism of that came out of the commentariat, I thought, oh, well, maybe voters are alert to the dangers of moving your vote away from the main parties. But quite the contrary has happened. I think what we have to accept now is that voters are consciously voting for these non-major parties as a deliberate act to try and communicate to the political elite, if you will, that they hold particularly strong views on some issues that the major parties won't address, and they're trying to communicate those through the upper house vote, which is fair enough. Presumably, that's precisely what proportional representation is supposed to do. So an interesting outcome in the upper house.
Well, I see in Western Victoria region that Vote One Local Jobs looks like it could get that fifth Legislative Council spot, but they only got 1.25% of the primary vote, so preferences have played a role. Did you think that after the federal election, the fact that people could vote below the line by only filling out five boxes would have minimised perhaps some of these minor parties getting in?
Yeah, I mean, you point to, you're drawing attention to what's going on. It's not so much what the primary vote was won by any particular individual candidate. I mean, I wouldn't like to say who's going to win these seats, because who knows? There's still a lot of votes to be counted. Preferences have to be distributed. Anything could happen. The key thing was, on the night, I was looking out for evidence that one of these micro-parties could win a seat. And the evidence would be a primary vote of cast for candidates other than Labor, Liberal, National and Green, of above the quota, above 16.7%. And in those rural regions, that was happening. Now, what's also interesting is that the vote for these, for others, is almost double the vote that others got for the lower house. Now, that suggests one of two things. It could be partly because there's not the same rate of candidature in the lower house as there is in the upper house. But secondly, it also suggests that voters consciously know what they're doing. They understand that they've got the opportunity to vote for these other parties in the upper house without actually disrupting the idea that one or either of the major parties will end up being the party of government. In some ways, what's interesting, and we should bear this in mind because there's going to be a huge outpouring of grief from certain commentators about this, but the outcome that we've got in the upper house is precisely that which was intended by the Constitutional Commission when they recommended changing the Victorian Constitution back between 1999 and 2002. Voters are exercising their choice. I think the third thing that should be said is we should also remember that the Legislative Council is not like the Australian Senate. The Victorian Constitution makes it very clear that the only thing that's needed to get a budget through the parliamentary process is a majority in the Legislative Assembly. So the Legislative Council cannot block supply, cannot bring a government down. Okay, so it doesn't have anywhere near the sort of power that the Senate has in federal politics. There's also in the Constitution provision for what's known as a joint heads of government or heads of parliament negotiation committee, so that if bills that are important get held up in the upper house process, there's scope for negotiation. In other words, there's no reason why good governance of the state can't proceed. It would have been a different story if Mr. Andrews had won a large number of seats but had these micro-party candidates in the lower house. That's a completely different matter. That hasn't happened. It looks like Labor will get a workable majority, even with an independent and a Green, or maybe a couple of Greens, and I don't anticipate there will be too many problems for the government in the upper house.
Now, on Saturday night, Anthony Green from the ABC, I was watching, and I think he said something along the lines of, if any government goes to the election with this same model in the Legislative Council, the upper house, of having votes come through and candidates elected, they deserve to be shot, was, I think, the terminology that he used. What do you think he means there, and what would they be reforming it to?
With his computer system, I wouldn't put too much in that.
Okay.
Let's say things in the heat of the moment. People get upset by the fact that a party can get elected with a paltry primary vote. We have to remember that, you know, when you look at the primary vote won by the successful candidates from the major parties, the chances are that the second-placed Labor candidate and the second-placed Coalition candidate on these tickets will also have a primary vote of about 1%. We have to remember that the single transferable vote system, which is the system we use, the system developed by Andrew Inglis Clark back in the 1890s, for precisely this purpose, for precisely allowing non-major party candidates or non-party people, because he was really against political parties back in colonial times, to allow them the chance to win a seat. So it's not really about the primary vote that the individual person has won. It's about the accumulated primary vote of all of the non-major party candidates who participate in that so-called preference harvesting activity. That is where they all say, right, we're going to direct our preferences to each other. Now, you make a very valid point that under the Victorian electoral system, voters do have the option to vote below the line and simply cast enough preferences for the number of positions to be filled. That is five. I think that the people have got that option. There was an attempt to try and explain that to people. People are not that interested in the complexities or the intricacies of the electoral system. They just want to go in and vote. I think we just have to accept that there is a sizable part of the Victorian community who are not happy with Labor, Liberal, National and the Greens, and they have taken the opportunity, as is their right, and as is allowed under the system, to cast a ballot for these micro-parties, as they're so-called, and that their voting choice is as legitimate as anyone's.
Yeah, well, we had election talk back here just before the election, and that was a lot of the feedback that was coming through, was that a lot of people really thought that the minor parties better represented their views.
Yeah.
But you talked about those key seats like Bentley and Frankston and Carrum and Mordialloc, where the government needed to win them. There was a swing against them. Do you think that the government miscampaigned in some of those seats, or was the swing inevitable?
No. There's a lot of waffle being expelled about what's just happened. A lot of spinning. I can get to the heart of the matter. It's two words. Jeff Shaw.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's an old adage, a very famous old stager in Australian politics. He once got it absolutely right. His name was Bob Hawke. And he said, as he was going to the polls in 1987, when the Coalition were tearing themselves apart as the Queensland Nationals were trying to put Joe Bjelke-Petersen in as Prime Minister and smash up the Coalition. And Hawke just simply said, you know, to the voters, look at these guys. They can't manage themselves. They can't run the country. And that's an abiding ethos in Australian politics. Mm. It is really important for the two major political parties to be unified. I mean, it surprises me that that people don't seem to learn from history. We've had so many incidences, past and present, where one of the major political parties tears itself apart over something. And the voters say, thank you, no, we're going to go with the other major party. The Liberals tore themselves apart from 2010 to 2014. Now, Jeff Shaw was the worst manifestation of it, but there were others. People forget that the member for Bunambra, Bill Tilley, threatened to cross the floor and join the crossbench over policing matters very early on when the Liberals won in 2010, thereby indicating that far from being unified and disciplined, the Liberals were going to indulge in what I consider to be absolute self-indulgence and hubris. Mm. And as a result, the voters have said, well, sorry, you know, the reason why we vote for the major parties is we want the major parties to deliver stability and order in the governing process. That's why they get that big vote in the lower house contest, and then in the upper house, where people understand the upper house isn't quite as important as the lower house, they're prepared to move their votes elsewhere. So the Liberals broke that fundamental principle in politics generally, but especially in state politics, because it's all about service delivery, state government, you've got to be functional, you've got to be unified, you've got to be disciplined. The Liberals were none of those things, and the voters in the marginal seats who judge the parties on these things said, nope, sorry, we're going to the other side. Mm. Now, everything else that's being said about this election, Tony Abbott, Bill Shorten, campaigns, there's nonsense that's been written about people and their campaigns. You know, it's very easy when you've won an election to run around and say, gee, our campaign was good. Look at that. The result proves how good our campaign was. Well, the reality is that it wasn't really about what Labor did. It's about what the coalition did when it was in power. But here's another axiom for you, and I'm going to have to finish on this one, Mitch. So I'm going to have to go.
No worries, yeah.
That people don't vote oppositions in, they vote governments out.
Yes, I would have quoted that one as well. Well, thank you so much, Nick. I appreciate you giving the time that you have to us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you. Nick Economy there, expert from Monash University. And there was, of course, a few more questions that I wanted to ask Nick, but he had to head off. I mean, one of the big questions I wanted to ask was this comment from Andrew on Twitter that says that the Greens bought the win in Melbourne by spending 10-1 on Labor. They focused all their election efforts in Melbourne, in Richmond, in Brunswick, in Prahran, and that they just completely dominated there. Of course, it's interesting to see the swing to the Greens, even though there was a bit of a swing to Labor around the state. I mean, I was thinking with the increase in the Greens vote in Melbourne in the 2013 federal election, that might have been because the Labor vote went backwards and people were switching over to the Greens. But it seems like statewide, what's happened is the Greens have picked up votes, despite Labor also picking up votes. So it's an interesting situation. Also, I see that Michael Gidley, the Member of Parliament for Mount Waverley in The Age, says that the Liberal Party tried too much to be like Labor Lite, he says. I'd be interested to hear what people think about that. And he said that they didn't look after small businesses enough, and they weren't being like a true centre-right party. They were trying to appeal too much to the left. Well, still ahead, Monday Sport, plus the Christmas tree. Is it the biggest Christmas tree in Australia? Bodie Dittloff from the Circular Head Chronicle is joining us next. This is Mitchell's Front Page on The Pulse.